nothing jumped out at me, and I wanted to give everybody an opportunity to free associate a little bit. We can do a few minutes now, and then if you have other ideas, send them to me. We've done the sort of molecules to humans things. We've done stuff about the face. We did some genetic stuff. The question is, where do we think we will be in 8 months that we want to be able to highlight? And I think that, again, there's real value in doing this, not only to inform the scientific community about what CFAS specifically does, but to keep CFAS's profile up there as we begin to confront our next renewal. So anybody who has ideas, feel free to speak, and certainly if this is just a way of prompting your right brains, then start to send me something soon. I believe we have until the end of the month, beginning of December. And then the other thing, at the same time, we have the same deadline almost exactly, November 30th, for ISBRA. And again, I think it's really valuable to be able to highlight the work of CFAS internationally as well. We had a CFAS symposium in Paris, and I think that we want to look at opportunities for doing something like that again. So it doesn't have to be vastly different from one to the other. There are a lot of reruns between RSA and ISBRA because they're just a few months apart. But thinking along that time horizon, really of sort of 8 to 10 months, and what will you have, and how can we organize that thematically? So if anybody has ideas, this is a good time to get the thinking started.
This is Elizabeth. And I just off the top of my head, I'm wondering if we have enough looking at environmental factors or intervention, you know, things that impact the brain and cognition, but maybe not the face. I don't know if we have enough sort of multidisciplinary on that, but I'm thinking like, you know, socioeconomic status. I don't know. Just thinking out loud.
Okay. So, you know, one way to come at this is just to think about what each of you might have in the coming 8 months or so that I can then try to weave together into a narrative that's different from past narratives. So if you have something that is CFAS related and will mature over that time period, then speak up and we'll try to figure out how to weave it together.
Yeah, I mean, I do. I think I'm starting to work on sort of brain and SES. I'm sure it won't take 8 months because we have a lot of data.
Right, and this is separate from your recent publication.
Oh yeah, this would be in the CFAS sample.
Because you know, certainly you could talk about that work as well. It was published since the last RSA meeting, but it would be nice to.
No, I'm talking about looking for, you know, group by SES interactions to see if, you know, or even within the exposed. That's what I'm thinking about.
Yeah, and is Julie Cable on?
Yeah, I was thinking of her too.
Well, I was thinking, you know, if we follow that theme, I don't know if they're far enough along with their program to be able to speak to results of what amount to environmental interventions.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But that would unify things nicely.
Yeah.
Right.
So I'll ask her where things stand. Claire is not either, so we're still
right.
Today. But any other things that people see maturing over the course of the next 8 months?
So, Michael, I was thinking that for a sort of a common theme, if you're going to need a common theme and to weave probably a number of things. Maybe we can't get everything under environmental or whatever. But maybe a new theme could be the application of new technologies for FASD research. And then you could get into the RNA-seq types of things, sort of, different imaging technologies. I know we've done imaging technologies before, but I think we have more functional applications now with our group. And so, you know, just a new technologies thing, and that could let a lot of different, you know, facets of our group come together.
It's a great idea. That idea, and we could shade among these ideas as we craft something separate for RSA and ISBRA. But each of these ideas would have to be accompanied by an abstract probably in the next 2 to 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. So you'd have to have something in mind that you could say that would have at least a foundation in current data. Mm-hmm. And I think these are good ideas because it's a different way of formulating how we could create a theme for a symposium. So any other ideas or something just over the horizon that you're ready to commit to an abstract, anyone else?
So this is just a parallel, this is Bill Barnett, just a parallel idea. Have you thought about using this as an opportunity to reach out to potential external collaborators as well? Sorry.
I think that's always a collateral benefit of doing something like this, that somebody is sitting in the audience and they see a technique or an approach that they hadn't considered, and they maybe have data or a population to which those techniques or approaches could be applied. So that's certainly an intended goal.
Yeah, I'm also thinking about, you know, our goal of making our data more widely available and used also.
It's something to think about. We haven't, I don't believe, had a paper from CFAS that sort of lays out what we have and how it can be exploited, and a presentation that talks about that would be timely. We're 13 years into this, so we're actually quite overdue for explaining to the scientific community more publicly what we have and how they can access it. That's a good idea.
Yeah, this is John. I like that idea, too. I endorse that one.
Yeah.
So depending on the success of Helen's presentation today, she and I were going to have a follow-up conversation about a paper on the technologies and processes that we're using to make these data available. So we appreciate all of your input on the presentation today.
So I look forward to that. Any other ideas among those who are on? Things that you know are ripening.
Right. And the deadline is December 1st.
Yes. So, within 2 days, we'd have to do both. I'm happy to put these together, but I just need the raw materials.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. Well, this is a good start. What I think I will do is write something up briefly for Jill to distribute and try to get people to send something back and see if we can find some way to weave it together. And I really think we should have something at both. We'll do the best that we can. So thank you.
Thanks, Michael. So is Peter on yet?
I haven't heard anything back from him either. I am so sorry. I didn't think about the time difference.
So this might be a good time then to turn it over to Helen. Helen, are you ready to present on WebEx?
I think I do. Do I need to share the screen?
Hey, Elizabeth, you might want to hit the little button. We can see your little thing that looks like a video camera, unless you don't want to be seen.
I don't want to be seen, but I can't figure out how to turn it off. Oh, okay. We got it.
Okay.
So, Helen, you should be able to share a screen.
Okay.
I'm not seeing anything. Is that just me, or is that...
Yeah, I'm trying to. It's still
working. Oh, there we go. Something's
working.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see it?
Coming.
I just see blank. Oh, there we go.
I see it.
There it is. There it is.
Do you see the slide?
Yep, I do.
Okay. Oh, thank you very much. So today we would like to present the project that we were working during the August and September to provide access to the external users to our phase one data. And we have several key objectives, requirements that we wanted to cover by this project. The first, of course, is providing information security for our data. And we, among other ways, you know, we approached it the way that we wanted to provide maximum security and eliminate any opportunity for data to be contaminated or altered in any way. So we decided to create separate replica of the central repository. And what helped us to do that we actually were working with static data. So the phase one data is not updated, and we consider it static. In addition to that, we use only de-identified data. You probably all remember that we were working on that to provide a list of attributes that would be would signify, you know, how they identified our data, our subjects. The second requirement was to provide granular access to the particular subtests that users are going to be accessing, and this access would be based on the data use agreement. In addition to that, we track the access to when was it, what kind of reports people would be downloading and using. So complete login is presented as well. And the third one, since our data is much more limited than what we have in central repositories due to the identification and the static nature of the data. Oh, sorry. Do you still see my slides?
No, I don't see them now.
I see them.
Okay, so due to the nature of the data, we were able to actually use REDCap. It's a clinical data management tool, and what was very useful about this tool is that it provides interactive reports where people can actually choose what kind of data sets they would like to see and the fields. And in addition to that, we provide new statistical formats for download. And the next slide, I would like to demonstrate you the prototype of the manual that we will be providing for the external users. So you're welcome to comment or provide any additions and suggestions how to make it better for the users. So here we actually, I think it's kind of incredible moment in our history of the consortium that we provide, the first time we provide access to the external users to the central repository. In order to do that, users first need to be request the REDCap account, and they would need to specify that this account is for the external access for CFS data, and that I provide the link how to access the REDCap account. And actually, every one of you, if you would like, if you're interested in see how it looks, please don't hesitate to do it. I would be glad to add you to the complete data set so you will be able to see how, you know, the complete possibilities of this project. REDCap is a versatile tool that provides a lot of help for users to do their work. And when users are provided with the account, they present it with the home page. So it will look like that. On the tabs, user will see My Projects, and specific users will be seeing specific project created for them, but users will be grouped based on their data use agreement that they signed previously. So when they click on the project, they will see the dashboard. In this dashboard, it's interactive report as well, but it's automatically created by the REDCap. They will see individual subjects, with all the data sets, if you see green here, it means that data for this particular data set was completed, and some of the records we have incomplete there. But you can see it's very visual. Right away, the user will be seeing, for example, what kind of data sets are available for that particular subject. And if people would click on that, for example, on, let me see. So, for example, if they would like to see records for the subject for SMS 62, they can just click on this green button and see that specific record right there. Under the application part, user will be presented with different reports. These reports, some of the reports are created by the RedCap, and some of the reports would be created by us. And in addition, the user can create their own reports there and store them there. This is type of the reports under the A and B. You can see pre-populated by RedCap tool. A reports provide all the data sets that would be available for the users. Then on the B part, users will be able to see individual subtests there and choose what they want. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 reports were created by me, and it's just the additional reports that they can use as well, based on the individual subtests that we have. In addition to that, the user can create a new report. So here they can provide the name of the report, they can see the fields from specific subtests. They can even use the different filters that are based on the or and requirements. What is very beneficial for the users here is statistical format of the report. If you can see that RedCap gives opportunity to download data in SPSS, SAS, R, and SATA format. Okay, and then one more feature that I don't know if users will be able to use it. They will be able to use it, but I don't know how useful it's going to be. It's comparison between two records. For example, if people had some of the subjects have several phase one times that their records were actually created. So you can, they will be able to compare those records here. For those users that will be provided with the genetic access, those users will be able to see the files in the file repository. And these files were specifically created for the phase one data. So they're just a little bit, you know, different from what we have on central repository. Under the reports part, here all the reports that users or me created. Those are not the reports that created automatically by RedCap, but only reports that were created by the users. So if they created new ones, they will be seen right here. And that's complete my manual, and if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to ask. Thank you.
Thanks, Helen. Did anyone have any questions or comments?
It's Michael, I'm looking at this from the narrow vantage point of how this could be talk in a symposium. And I think it really is something that we should present. We'll need three others, but just to be able to present to the community a how-to, I wonder if it would be possible in the demonstration to take this a little bit further and to walk through asking a specific question, maybe one that we've already answered and that somebody is publishing or has published, but just to say, you know, if you had a specific question about the relation between the size of a brain region and a particular neurocognitive function test, how would you do it? You know, can you do cross-query? And how would you look at two variables to really bring this right to somebody's own computer and to give people a sense of potential mastery for being able to analyze these data? Is that something that would be feasible?
May I ask, please, are you talking about this particular project to help users to understand how to work with the phase one data?
Yeah, just to be able to extend what you've just shown us.
Mm-hmm.
I have a specific example. You know, here's how it is. Here's how you sign up. This is what the data look like. And now I'm going to show you how you can do, for example, a comparison or correlation, let's say, of a certain neurocognitive function and a certain brain region. And to be able to just walk through that and show what the data would look like and what one might need to do, even to the point of, you know, showing what the correlation would look like if it's possible to do that. Just to have slides for that, not to do it live. But to be able to walk people through a real example of an analysis.
Michael, this is Sarah Jo, and I was thinking similarly, not as well, of course, but that one of the issues is that I'm thinking from the perspective of a reviewer when it comes back up, and I think the more we can do about making sure people know these data are available or are very close to being available, how they can be used, is going to be a very critical component of the next review.
So this is Elizabeth. I'm also thinking, Michael, I'm not sure there is brain data in phase one. It doesn't mean it couldn't be, Helen, there's no brain or
right.
Everyone.
Well, I don't think there has to be brain data.
Yes, we didn't have the data for the phase one, so we provided only the data that we had in central repository.
Yeah, it could be face and neurocognitive. It could be anything. Just pick
it could be anything.
Two reasonable variables that a person might want to look at and just show them how to get there.
Right. I think it would be possible, and I think maybe even live version to demonstrate how to create new reports, for example.
I would love to see that. And,
mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's very easy to do that.
It's actually breaking the energy barrier for people who might want to do this but are afraid it's too hard, just showing how easy it is to do. And you'll see people in the audience downloading stuff or signing up for REDCap as they sit there. If it's a little too mysterious, people won't go near it, except people mm-hmm. who have really very strong data mining skills to begin with. And they're not necessarily the ones that we want in to make this accessible to, that we want people who have really good ideas from their own work who mm-hmm. might want to test them in the CFAS database.
Yeah. This is Bill. I think with a little kind of guidance from our researchers on this, we could come up with a nice question that we could kind of walk people through. I think that's easy. I think that can be done, no problem.
So, Bill or Helen, has the Red Hat interface been linked then to the phase one data, or is it's just being proposed?
I think it's running.
Currently, we already have the project is running. It's live. We didn't have any requests to access it. So we just provided access to data managers of particular groups. So, for example, we have Ben Devsey from Sarah's group, we have Jordan from Tina's group, and Leah to access the data and, you know, to be our testers, like guinea pigs, to see if it works correctly and they have any comments. But I would encourage you to access this project, and so in order to access it, you would need to create the RedCap account first. So After that, I will be able to add your information, your user, to the project, so you will be able to explore it yourself. And I think the more people we have on the initial stage, the better the tool would work.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
All right, thanks, Helen. We have Peter on now, so to give him enough time to give his presentation. Peter?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Is the sound okay?
Yes.
Yes.
Good. Okay, first of all, apologies. It was a big slip over the British summertime change, and also I was called into a meeting at the last minute, which I couldn't get out of. Okay.
I'm not seeing your screen yet, though.
You're not. Oh, I have to press the button first, don't I?
Yeah.
Yep. You have to accept it, usually, is what you need to do, I think. In the WebEx screen under Quick Start, in the middle of the screen, just hit Share Screen or Share My Desktop, whatever it is.
Okay. Are we there?
Yep.
Yes.
Oops. Okay, so there are two parts to the update. One is on recent work on the past space analysis, and which I've mainly been working on, and Mike's been focusing on the place brain stuff. So I'll try and get through this as quickly as I can. Starting with the past data. So the situation was, we got the alcohol and smoking exposure data in November last year, but as you know, we've been focusing on these new measures and using curvature and groove index and stuff on the face. So we haven't got back to the past data until August, also because I took June and July out, as you know, when I moved from London to Oxford. So since the beginning of August, we've now entered about 60% of the data into our model. So we've got potentially 1,000 individuals each with a 3D picture at 1 month and 1 year. And we've now got about 600 in. Now most of those we have both a 1 month and a 1 year. But for some, we can only put the 1 month or the 1 year in. I hope you can see this image now, which is showing some spikes. I don't know whether you can you see my cursor moving?
Yep.
Yes. Yep.
Yes, there's a spike right in the filtrum on this image, and on this one to the right, there's a hole. Now, we could, of course, smooth that spike out, and we could fill the hole, but the danger is then we're affecting the very area that we're supposed to be looking at for smoothness. So really, we have to omit those images, and we can't use them. Hence, we don't always have a pair for every individual. And the next stage is to put the 20 manual landmarks on each face, and as you can imagine, that takes time, and for each of the 600, we've got pretty well two images, so you're talking about 1,200 images that needed to be landmarked, which was quite time-consuming. And then we built a model, and we've got some initial results, but I wanted to just say something about the exposure data without, you know, giving the public viewing of the data. So I wanted to just give you an idea of what form it's in. So for instance, for drinking information, for an individual, you would have something like this, which is stretching over 43 weeks, say, of a pregnancy, and each vertical bar is indicating how many days in that week that mother has suggested she was drinking. So for instance, this individual starts off close to the beginning of pregnancy, drinking 2 days a week, and then it goes up to three. And then you sometimes get gaps. When that could mean there's no drinking, or it could mean there's no record in the collection of information. So that, of course, is a particular problem, is what something means about that. So all the records are sporadic like this. Many, of course, of which will be zero right the way through. I thought it would be interesting to look at the sort of average overall profile of days drinking over the whole data set. And so you get a mean sort of declared drinking in terms of days by the week. Obviously, at the beginning, mothers don't know they're pregnant, so they may carry on drinking. And then it goes down once they know they're pregnant. And then there seems to be a little bit of a, in the second trimester, a bit of a bump. And then another slightly smaller bump in the third trimester. Hang on, I've gone too quickly. So that's the sort of drinking data. Smoking data is more like this. So information is provided about the year before conception, you know, the year before the pregnancy started. So that's why I've got this line going across horizontally. And then for the, you know, the 9 months of the pregnancy. So this picture in the middle is supposed to be conception, and the picture on the right is delivery of the baby. So the smoking information might be like this. So this is saying 7 days a week this individual was smoking, basically smoking every day. There is information on how many they smoked, minimum number, maximum number, but this is just saying there was 7 days a week smoking. Then you notice again there's a gap. It could be because there's no information, or it could be zero, and then it changes as time goes on. So again, you've got sporadic information. So it's hard to try and work out how best to use this information when you've got such gaps or such changes over time. So what I decided to do was to start off by looking for some control. So there are some individuals where, for all the records you have, you can see there was no drinking and no smoking. So I've got about 100 individuals I'm using in this pattern as control. What I did notice was that there were some small differences between male and female in the shape of the filter. Now, I mention this because we found kind of filter difference in our South African data where I just wanted to, you know, to kind of show that there is this difference in male and female, so that means that we really must separate male and female. Whereas in the South African data, we couldn't afford to do that because we didn't have numbers, but we have got the numbers now. I just wanted to say what that difference is. So here's the filtrum of the sort of average of these 50 females at 1 year, and on the right the male, and you can see that this is our curvature, our groove curvature. You can see the filtral pillars. You can see the groove in the middle is stronger in the female average than in the male. And also you might be able to see that the female filtrum is wider. And these are discriminating differences, which I was a little surprised at. And by doing some typical sort of comparison of filtrum shape and doing some unseen testing, we were able to discriminate, in a sense, predict sex from the shape of the filtrum as much as 80% of the time. That's what these numbers mean. So this is the probability of correctly classifying male or female. Obviously, it's not perfect, but it's suggesting, you know, it's confirming that there is some kind of difference there that we need to take into account, and we need to keep the sexes separate. Okay, so that's what I'm using as control. And the first group of affected children I thought I would look at, I thought I'd make it easy. I'm going to first of all look at individuals who have been exposed daily to smoking, but no alcohol. I also thought I'd do this because it's novel, because we haven't looked before at smoking, and we haven't looked at alcohol exposure. Now, another reason why I've done this is because a few weeks ago, we had a talk by someone called Tom Fleming, and he showed us some interesting animal experiments where the nutrition of the mother around about the period of conception had a very strong effect on subsequent growth and development of the fetus and the offspring. And this was at the stage when the embryo was just a few cells and in a sense was responding to the uterine environment. So what I thought I would do is look at people who've been smoking significantly right up to conception, then maybe smoking thereafter, to make sure that it's, you know, kind of fitted in with this paper's work where you're interested in what's happening at the time of conception. So I'm going to give you an example then of two small groups we've looked at. So on the chart at the top, you can see to the left of the image representing conception, the year before, and then afterwards then is the pregnancy itself. Actually, I've got an image on my screen covering the picture of the baby. There we are. So the first group we looked at were the infants whose mothers had smoked daily for the year before they conceived. And then there was some smoking during pregnancy, not necessarily daily, but and I'm not even thinking at the moment about how many cigarettes were used, but also no drinking. Okay, so it's daily smoking, preconception, some drinking during pregnancy, but no drinking. And this is the effect that we found. So first of all, there's the side effect. So this is the average of 51 individuals who satisfy those criteria, smoking and no alcohol exposure. And so you can see for this female average, at 1 year, you've obviously got this this red indicating size reduction. Remember, green means the same as the average, red means smaller, blue means bigger. So there's a slight sort of prominence across the nasal bridge, which is fairly minor. But these color heat maps are at half a standard deviation, which is actually fairly high for comparing averages. Then you look at the male one, and you don't get quite the same size reduction, but you do get some shape difference. So there is an effect there, but I think that the interesting effect is when you focus on lateral difference. So for instance, now I'm looking at the same two averages, female and male, female at the top, male below, but now the color indicates, blue indicates a shift to the left as you look, and red to the right. So for instance, in the top image, you can see the inner canthus is moving outward on the right, and on the left, the inner canthus is moving to the right as you look, moving outward. So that's shortening the palpable fissure width. And obviously, you've got this blue on the left and red on the right of the face, indicating the, you know, the smaller dimension. And that turns out to be, let me move this out of the way, that turns out to be statistically significant in terms of the reduction in the palpable fissure length. On the male side, it's slightly different. It seems to be an inner movement of the exocanthi. And when I looked at the palpable fissure length, it wasn't significant. But the distance between the exocanthi, the reduction that there was, it didn't hit the 0.5 level, but it was, you know, close to it. And then I looked at the second group where I changed the smoking during pregnancy to daily. So we're now looking at daily smoking prior to conception, daily smoking throughout pregnancy, no drinking. And what happens now is you get similar effects, but they're stronger. So for instance, the PFL reduction is a bit more significant, 0.039 instead of 0.04, whatever it was. Well, it's pretty well the same, really. But now the exocanthi difference actually is highly significant in terms of, and that's probably affecting the width of the face as well. You also notice there's some asymmetry in the differences as well, especially in the lateral displacement difference. Now, that's all I've got so far to mention on this particular call. And one of the things I was wanting to get a response on is, what do you think about choosing these populations, you know, where I'm focusing on no drinking, but focusing on this kind of incessant smoking exposure? Any comments?
This is very timely because, as everyone knows, there is growing interest in the synergistic effects of different drugs that people take during pregnancy on outcomes well into the adolescent period, and this really fits in what NIAAA and NIDA are trying to do together in looking at how some of these interact. You're starting off by looking at smoking, but obviously you'll be able to look at the combined effects as well when you're further along. And I think this is going to be very important.
Right.
Peter, can I ask a question? So what was your sample size to start with?
I think it's nearly 600.
Okay, so, and then so presumably you had to throw out a lot for those little peaks and points where they shouldn't be? Or did you? Was it a lot?
No. When I get down to, you know, numbers of 50 or 30, it's because, you know, I'm not considering at the moment individuals who smoke occasionally.
Yeah.
Or I mean, here I'm completely excluding those who drank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
See, I'm assuming here that we're only looking at non-drinkers. So that's why the numbers have gone down substantially.
Mm-hmm.
Peter, I've got a question. This is Dale. So you pointed out a collection of asymmetries here, and it makes me wonder if that has anything to do with cilia and their function.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe others who are more knowledgeable about developmental biology can weigh in.
I don't know. I would. The other thing we would have to make sure we rule out is that it's not something to do with our landmark placement, which is, you know,
uh-huh,
inducing some sort of asymmetry. But I doubt it would.
Yeah, I would doubt that too. Kathy's on. What do you think, Kathy?
Well, certainly in our animal models, we've always seen a lot of asymmetry. The right side's always more severely affected in mice, in the mice that we use. We really don't know the reason for that. It, with our current bias, we think it's related to hedgehog signaling and the amount of hedgehog being different on the right than the left side of the embryo and the requirements. So, asymmetry, I think, of teratogenic effects is typical in mice, and I think we certainly know for a lot of birth defects the asymmetry is typical in people. Cleft lip is almost always on the left. So, I think it's interesting but not surprising that you're seeing asymmetry.
Yeah, I mean, there is an underlying asymmetry in the brain, isn't there, in the general population, with a right-sided dominance where the right hemisphere is further forward than the left, and that then gets reflected in the shape of the skull and obviously then in the face.
Hey, Peter, Scott, how sure are you that smoking was the only, or nicotine was the only drug?
We can't be. Can't be sure. No.
Mm-hmm. Good. Did they collect other drug information? I'm trying to remember. Dale or Bill, do you remember that from past? I'm guessing they would, but how frequent is it in that population?
Yeah, the frequency of smoking?
Non-smoking, other drugs, I think is what was being asked, if I understood the question.
Yeah, off the top of my head, I don't know those numbers, but they do ask questions about a variety of things, methamphetamine and... But these are tend to be yes, no, and not as well calibrated or quantified.
But Dale, do you know that is meth a big problem in that region, or?
I didn't think it was. That's what I was looking for, really. I didn't think it was, but I could be wrong.
And did they do any tox screens at any point with these patients before or after delivery?
No, they've only done kind of pilot scale biomarker stuff, but on small samples.
This is Kirsty. This is the South African group,
yes,
isn't it?
Cool.
Yes.
And Hein, yeah.
So I can give a little bit of insight about the other drug use in the population. There is
a massive methamphetamine epidemic. And what we're finding with on our current study is that people are readily admit to alcohol, but they won't admit to methamphetamine. And the methamphetamine and other drugs that we've picked up has almost been exclusively on urine testing. So I doubt that they, I doubt that even if the questions were asked, that people admitted to it.
That's good to know.
Yeah. That's really helpful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
One feature of the data that you showed, Peter, that is very interesting is the histogram of drinking throughout pregnancy and the already known tendency for drinking to decline after the first trimester. What's interesting about it is that the only other data I've seen, the SAMHSA data and the CDC data, tend to have information about one epoch or about drinking in the last month. And so they kind of stitch together something that demonstrates that first trimester is, you know, twice or three times second and third trimester. But I've never seen anything with this kind of very detailed fluctuation that you've demonstrated, which also, you know, others may know more about this, may be unique.
Yeah, so this is Elizabeth. I've been looking at the same data, and these moms continue to drink a lot. And the other thing, Michael, relevant to your question is, from my understanding, they do timeline follow-backs regularly throughout pregnancy or from the first prenatal visit. So this data is kind of different than the retrospective samples that we often see.
Yeah.
The other interesting thing I think about this data set is that it was more of a community sample. So they weren't trying to find moms who drank a lot compared to moms who didn't drink at all. This has a real range of drinking behavior, which I think is a huge value to this population.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually have brain data on about 70 kids, pilot, and it would be interesting, Peter, to see if we could see if something about the face at 1 year can tell us something about the brain at 7 years. Don't you think?
Well, yeah, and in fact, you've now segued into because I just wanted to give a quick update on what Mike's been doing. Which is repeating some earlier face brain that we've done, but now the data set's grown a fair bit, and I just wanted to show you that the similar results that we had before are still true with this expanded data set. Plus also, I just wanted to briefly mention one little problem that Mike's concerned about. So for instance, here we have a model that combines the face and the corpus callosum, and it's showing the mean Caucasian FAS, actually Caucasian plus Hispanic FAS face, showing the big reduction in size as you get, that's what the red is, and then on the right you're seeing corpus callosum, which actually, it's hard to interpret, but if you look at this right-hand end here, red means this surface is going in and blue means this surface is coming the opposite way, so it's showing the reduction in the thickness of the corpus callosum, as we had before. So that's gone through with the, you know, additional examples we've added. And then if you look at the heavy exposure subgroup, of course, the facial features are more subtle, but you're getting some reduction, but you can actually see, whereas with the FAS, the smalls of the face swamps the philtrum, here there's not such size reduction, and you can see kind of a bit of blue in the middle of the philtrum showing some smoothing at this end of the philtrum. And you get a similar effect on the corpus callosum as we did before. If you throw them all together and just call them exposed, then you get a kind of halfway house as you might expect. So those results are still holding for this extension to the data set on the Caucasian Hispanic group. Now, so in that data we've separated out African American, and I'll come to that a bit later on. We also, Mike also retested the effect of adding the corpus callosum to discriminating on the face. So you see on the left here, just using the face, we get these rates of discrimination. Remember, these are probabilities, depending on which part of the face you look at. And if you then add, in a combined model, the corpus callosum, it makes between a 5 and a 10 point difference shift in the, an increase in the classification rate. So again, that's following on and is consistent with what was before. What this is showing here is quite a busy slide, but basically Mike's gone on then to look at the corpus callosum model, principal components, which is along this row here, and linking it with some of the older face measures like palpal fissure width, but also, you know, this measure we proposed for lip thickness, which is the sort of average height of the cupid's bow, and also this new measure, this fulsome groove index, which, as you know, in this figure here, is the volume of the fulsal groove divided by its length. And it's showing correlations between that volume, for instance, here, and different principal components. And this is the principal component number one on the right, which you can see morphing. And above, you can see this correlation between the volume of the fulsal groove and the first principal component of the corpus callosum model. So that's a nice link, echoing what has been done before, but using this new measure. And then this is a slide showing similar thing, but with that principal component number 5, linking it with palpal fissure width. So the problem that we've been trying to address, Mike's been communicating with people within CFAS, is that when he looked at the corpus callosum shape in the African-American subgroup and the Caucasian subgroup of the CFAS data, he found that he could actually discriminate between them highly, significantly. And that was a slight concern because, you know, you might expect, well, you can't put different ethnic groups' faces together, but you would expect to put the brains together and analyze them together. But if you've got this discriminating difference already, and then you're going to look at the effect of alcohol, it's just a slight concern. And so Mike's been trying to work out, with help from Elizabeth's people and others, is this something to do with the scanner that was used? Is it to do, you know, to do with the site, or whatever? But it's something that we still perhaps haven't really got to the bottom of, and it's something that, you know, we need to address. I don't believe it's an ethnic difference.
Out of the Ping sample, I know that people have been looking at that data using genetic ancestry factors and actually looking at shapes and sizes of things as, you know, as using ancestry is a measure of interest. So I think we kind of know there might be shape differences in the brain, kind of like there are sort of characteristic shape differences in the face and the body. So, you know, we expect differences, but we don't expect those differences to be meaningful, right? So it's like the shape of a nose may be different, but it's doing the same thing. So I don't know, but your point is well taken. But anyway.
The question is, when we write this up, how should we, you know, make it explicit, or because, you know, it's dangerously...
politically, I mean, we can certainly correlate it with principal components. I think a lot of these people do have principal components because we specifically prioritize those people who had MRI. Just Peter and I both talked about this. I mean, if you go look in the literature, there's not a lot about race and brain region size differences. I mean, I dug around trying to find something and couldn't find much that had been published. So we certainly don't want to go into a territory that could get us in trouble.
Yeah, but I think I'll try to find out who is doing the genetic ancestry. And keep in mind, if you're looking at, is that self-report of African-American or Caucasian?
Not of them are confirmed by the GWAS.
Yeah, these have been confirmed by the GWAS study.
Oh, okay.
Oh, huh.
And the vast majority of them have been anyway.
Well, couldn't you then use ancestry as a covariate to sort of say we don't, you know, that's not variability that we care about.
Well, if you look at the morph in the middle of the screen, the kind of slight concern for me is that the difference is to do with the thinning of the shape of the corpus callosum. And that means, you know, that's kind of close to the difference that we find when we're looking at the effect of alcohol.
But is there a correlation between alcohol use and genetic ancestry?
We'd have to look at that. I hate to say it. I gotta get off. And this is
yeah,
exactly the part I would have wanted to start talking about. I am so sorry. I've got to go to another meeting. They're all waiting for me.
We are running a few minutes late, so we may need to carry on this conversation.
Next week.
Well, we'll meet again next week. So maybe
next
that's
time.
Close enough.
Yeah. Any other final questions or comments then?
Well, I want to know what everyone thought about the new report that came out and all the news about no alcohol and any pushback from women saying it's not fair. You can't take this away from us.
Well, I didn't hear any of the pushback.
Ooh, okay. There's a lot, believe me.
I didn't either.
Well, I believe you. I just hadn't seen it. I just hadn't seen
right.
it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I was interested to actually read that article in Pediatrics, and it isn't quite what it's about. It's just kind of a general review.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. But, that's right.
But they grabbed essentially two sentences and made a lot out of that. And I think that says a lot about how volatile that subject is.
And if it ever becomes available online, I did a little piece on local ABC News where, you know, the health reporter wanted to know, why are you doing this? What does it mean? Is there something new? And so I had to kind of explain to her, well, it's not really new. They're just, you know, we're feeling a need to say, hey, wait a minute. So, anyway.
Well, actually, I was called also. I was talking to the Manchester Guardian called.
Mm-hmm.
And I said essentially the same thing. No, you know, it's not new, and this is the message that needs to be there.
And I just kind of said, you know, in the scientific community, we've seen these popular press and media reports that it's okay, and we just feel a need to say, wait a minute, we don't know that there's any safe amount at any time. So,
John, when the Manchester Guardian called you, who did you endorse for the nomination?
Would these links that you guys are being put on the news be appropriate for the CFAS website?
Yeah, I need to get it. But the other thing I think is that even just having this conversation in the media now is good, right? Mm-hmm. Any discussion of it is better than people just sort of making their own opinions without really, you know, the facts. Or the lack of that.
Right.
And it is one more group that has essentially endorsed a no-tolerance policy.
And that's very good.
Yeah, and they can influence their membership, and maybe pediatricians will be asking those questions.
Yeah, or OBGYNs, right? It's not just pediatricians.
Well, I think, didn't this come out of AAP?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's what I thought, but yeah.
No, it did, but I'm just saying is we need to get
ACOG, yes. They would also have a role to play here.
Yeah.
But we went through a consensus process here, many of you would know, several years ago, and it led to AAP writing a position piece on what the field of pediatrics should be thinking about with these affected kids. So, it seems like there's a progression that's going on here, and if they can pass that along to practitioners, that would be great.
Agreed.
Yep. All right. Well, we're about 7 minutes over. So thank you, everyone. Like I said, I think there's just a reminder too at the very end here of making sure you go through all the public policy, publication policy, and any news items. Just forward those to me.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you very much.